Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Artificial Talk. I'm your host, Tristan, and with me today, I have my co-host,
Louie. Hello, everyone.
All right. It's been a while since we've been on the podcast together, and we're going to jump right into it. So, let's talk about the end of an era. So, Louie,
yes.
Do you remember free stuff on the internet?
I do remember free stuff. It was always nice to be able to just do things for free on the internet.
Yeah, so Google's ending that era. There's no more Google Photos, or free, actually, no, won't say it like that. There are no more free Google Photos, so no more of that free unlimited storage you had before. Documents from Google, like Google Docs and Google Sheets and all that, are now going to take up storage, so you're going to have to buy more storage in Google Drive. And honestly, it just reminds me of iCloud. So, I mean, Louie, give me your thoughts. How do you feel about this?
Honestly, for as long as we've used Google, everything has been free, from email to, you know, the essentially G Suite being free for basically anyone who had an account. You know, my family uses Google Photos on some devices to just back up their photos from their phone rather than having to buy iCloud storage, because, you know, Google Photos is free, or at least it used to be. And now, I don't know, I guess we're going to have to figure out a solution to all these things. I mean, a lot of people rely on Google Docs for, you know, let's say their startup or like starting a business. And now these things are no longer going to be free. Obviously, you know, it's not an arm and a leg. It's just like $2 a month or whatever. But, you know, it's still going to be a cost. And people are going to have to figure out what to use. I honestly can see a lot more tech savvy people moving over to like LibreOffice just to get away from having to pay.
I totally agree with you. It's a weird thought, though. I guess before, a big reason you're probably a lot of people are so into the Google ecosystem now. I mean, Gmail, of course, being the largest email service in the world. You've got Google Photos, which, as you said, even if you have like an iPhone, a lot of times you kind of just defaulted to using Google Photos because it stores all your photos. And to most people that don't have a very keen camera, you probably aren't going to notice that small quality change in your photos. Videos maybe a little bit more, because it goes from, if you're recording on to 4K or whatever, it goes down to 1080p, but even then, that's not crazy. You can, most
right,
displays
right.
Aren't even 4K.
Yeah, exactly. The average person doesn't have a 4K TV, a 4K monitor, a 4K laptop display, right? Most people just have, you know, a 1080p monitor and then their TV. I mean, I'm not sure if things have changed recently in the consumer market, but you know, TVs are relatively inexpensive now, even at the 4K level. So maybe then people would notice, but let's be honest, how many times are you going to be watching your iPhone video on your TV screen? You know, very rarely are you going to be doing that, unless it's like you have family over, you're like, oh, look at our vacation, right? And you're not vacationing every single day taking a million videos and photos. So I can see how, you know, people at first didn't really mind the you know, you basically paid, you know, your payment was your data and your and having lesser quality photos. So the average person, that was a great trade-off, because you have to pay free storage, basically, right? Free utility from having just a single email account. And now that you're gonna have to pay for these things, I'm not sure how the general consumer base is going to react to this. You know, people from young, you know, from children in school, you know, with Chromebooks and stuff, use this stuff. Obviously, if your school's on the program, they won't have to pay for it. But if you think of, like, let's say you go to a public school and you have a Chromebook, right, you're going to have to pay for this, and you might not be in the best situation to be able to pay for these things, right? It's going to be, obviously, it's not the end of the world. It's only $2 a month, but still, it's another $2 that you won't have to be able to buy anything else. So I can definitely see people either moving to, let's say, the free Microsoft suite online, because they have like a free, I believe you can use Word and Excel free online on their website. Don't quote me, but I think so.
I think you have to have at least one of their basic plans to use their online suite. I think so, if I remember correctly. It's actually very similar to how Google's doing it now. If you buy, like, I think it's 100 gigs of OneDrive storage, they'll let you use their whole suite, the online suite, and then you store stuff there. Almost exactly the same the way that Google Drive is doing it now.
You know, but sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say, is the only free option left, you know, free in quotes, free option left going to be LibreOffice and iCloud.com?
But even, okay, so that I was going to say, so this is kind of, in my mind, this is a huge industry change. This is a shift. Because, okay, while I think we look at things like iCloud.com as free, in reality, if you actually want to use things like iCloud storage, you only start with 5 gigabytes free. And to be entirely clear, Google's still giving that 15 gigabytes free, which is still more than I think every other company in the same space in terms of, yeah. So Google sort of already still gives you a bigger chunk for free than any other company does. But I think sort of the interesting thought process is now everyone is sort of falling in line with what I guess is expected. You know, you're going to have to pay $2 a month or whatever it is to get your cloud storage for not only just your documents anymore, but your photos, your videos, even your device backups. Because Google Drive is the place Android phones, depending on which phone you have, tends to back up to. Whereas, of course, you got Apple with iCloud, but iCloud, the 5 gigabytes is not even enough to do one backup for the most part. So it's kind of like everyone else is now falling into line with, I guess, the standard that the industry set in, rather than
of cloud storage, basically, rather than program payment. It's more of just cloud storage you're going to be paying for now, essentially.
Yeah. And it's kind of, and I'll be honest, it's a little bit, the cool thing about Google always was the fact that to an extent, they always offered a little bit more, again, for free. I say free in quotes, of course, you're trading your data for it. But now I think Google is finally understanding to an extent that having most of your revenue, I think it's close to 93% of your revenue based on ads, is a good idea until people stop buying ads. I mean, COVID this year obviously caused a lot of damage for them. Their market cap dropped from 1.2 trillion down to like 900 billion in less than a month because ad spending went down. I imagine that they're probably trying to find ways that they can start diversifying their money a little bit.
You know, the part of the problem probably is the increase in use of ad block as well, right? Because I have no metrics of this, but I could definitely predict a lot more people having installed ad blocker in the last 8 months because of COVID, being at home, watching, consuming more content online, right? Getting bothered with ads on YouTube, bothered with ads, you know, wherever you watch things, on websites and stuff like that. So I can definitely, and even to install AdBlocker, it's just so simple, right? You go onto your extension store, wherever that may be, Chrome extensions or Safari extensions or Firefox or whatever browser you use, you install it and that's it. Like it literally just takes maybe 10 clicks and then you have no more ads. So I think that's I have obviously no metrics of this. I have no idea if this is true, but I feel like that could definitely have factored into it, right? A lot of people try to block, you know, I included have attempted to block ads on a network-wide level rather than on a device level, you know, because I can't block ads on my Apple TV because it's not a browser, obviously, right? And to do that is such a difficult process because, you know, I don't know if you've ever looked into this stuff to block YouTube ads, let's say, but the same basically DNS that the video comes from is the same that the ad comes from. So it's very difficult to be able to block the ads and not the videos, right? Like they're being very cheeky now. But if you just do it on a per device level, you know, your phone, your laptop, you know, I could definitely see how this would push, you know, and the addition of people not buying advertisements as well, you know, due to business slowing down, the economy slowing down, people having less funds to be able to buy advertising. I can definitely see both being major factors in Google wanting to diversify how they make money, right? You know, I could definitely see a student version of search, you know, like Google Scholar essentially becoming a paid service at some point for mainly researching type things, right? Like I could definitely see that becoming a thing because almost no one uses it. It's very niche, so why not charge for it, right?
And I think, 100% agree with you. I think, as well as that, privacy has become a bigger and bigger question. And in particular, Google and Facebook are being sort of put in the spotlight now. Like, what are you going to do to curb that? And I mean, Facebook, for all intents and purposes, does not seem like they care about it at all, as we've talked about before. They seem to just ignore the fact that anybody cares about privacy. Google, on the other hand, for it's kind of weird. They seem like they care a little bit more. At least they act like they do. And for all intents and purposes, it might actually be a good thing that maybe they are going to get a larger source of revenue from another source that isn't advertising. It might give them more incentive to encourage a little bit more privacy across the industry, especially since they own the largest ad industry in the world, basically.
Right. Only basically second to that would be Facebook, I guess.
Facebook is a distant second, though, even then.
No, yeah, I know. But I definitely agree with you. It's, you know, it makes you wonder what other services Google's thinking of making paid at some point, right? Like, do you think, like, YouTube has YouTube Premium. Will there ever be a point in which basically entire channels get blocked unless you pay for YouTube Premium?
Oof, that's a scary future. But then again, I think about that and I'm like, okay, but if you're a business person at Google, you're looking at it, there's the videos that make millions of views, like the music videos that, you know, ads play on them. There's no issue with those. They pull in a lot of revenue for you. But then there's also those videos that don't have any ads on them. A good example, actually, I've heard brought up recently a lot more was that History of the World video that has, I think it's 100 million views or absurd number.
The Bill Wirtz video, the History of the Entire yes. World, I guess. Yes, that video yes. is amazing.
That video is amazing, and you'll notice as you watch it, there are no ads on that video at all. And it has over 100 million views, which means 100 million people watched it, and it brought in basically zero revenue for YouTube, as far as straight direct revenue. Maybe indirectly, people clicked on other links, but for our purposes, there was no direct revenue from that video. And I could see YouTube, you know, YouTube and Google, same company, but specifically YouTube saying, hey, this video has a lot of views, not pulling any money. How are we going to keep this video up, but also allow somebody else who has ads on the video who doesn't get as many views also be up at the same time? Like, that balancing act. So,
well, I can almost certainly within the next 5 years guarantee YouTube is going to not allow videos to be uploaded without ads. Like, I'm pretty sure it's just in the future that at some point every video will have to have at least one ad, either the beginning, the middle, or the end. They might give creator a choice as to where that ad goes, you know, but I definitely can see this being forced upon creators.
I mean, they already did. I don't know if you saw recently, they turned on the option. Every video has mid-roll. Yeah, every video has mid-roll, and everything in your past catalog. If you're a creator, all your past catalog now is mid-roll ad, which if you have got thousands of videos, for example, going back and turning it all off individually.
It's just basically impossible. Like, you're not going to do that.
You're not going to do it. Yeah, right. You're just not going to do it. It's not worth the time. But I don't know. It's an interesting shift in the whole industry. I think it definitely caught people off guard, especially in the pandemic. Although I personally think the pandemic is probably the catalyst for why Google's doing it now.
That's definitely.
Yeah.
You know, but a lot of the industry changes, I think, have mainly been because of pandemic, right? We're seeing work from home explode and companies basically being like, okay, we're going to keep offering this after COVID, right? It's cheaper for them to do, you know, and tech companies like Google are not immune to this pandemic, right? People, we already discussed this earlier. So it's definitely surprising coming out of Google, you know, a company that basically has thrived off of our data for so long, now essentially saying we need more than just your data to survive, right? Like, they might be comfortable right now, but they're making projections 10, 20 years in the future. You know, what's going to happen with privacy laws? What's going to happen with advertising laws, right? You know, are we going to, is advertising going to be reined in by the government? We have no idea, right? There is definitely predictions that we can make and possibilities and statistics and all this. So I can definitely see them, maybe they don't need this revenue now, but they are going to need it in 5, 10, 20 years. When advertising is no longer as feasible to be as sustainable a revenue source.
Yeah, and it's Google. They're a $1 trillion company. They understand how this works. Exactly. It's not their first rodeo.
If they're already making this shift and they already see this coming, then it's coming. Like if this is not happening for just because they want to, this is happening because they see a trend and it's going to keep going.
And Google's not the only one. Facebook is switching to the encrypted messaging thing and AR as their future, basically, because they've also realized the privacy thing. And I think I don't know if they discovered it earlier than Google. Maybe they just could move faster than Google because they're much smaller. But they're doing their whole shift. It's not, so this is an industry-wide shift. This is not just Google, but I think it's a good case study because Google is so big and has so many people that use it. I mean, over 900 million people use Gmail. So I don't think it's insane. I don't think it's crazy, you know, to say Google is sort of the harbinger for a lot of these sorts of things. So, but moving on, talking about privacy. We like privacy. We just talked about privacy for a straight, must have been 10 minutes there. So Apple. Now, Louis, when you think of Apple, what do you think of them in privacy?
I think of that petty advertisement they put outside of E3 on the building that said, "Privacy, that's iPhone." And, you know, those really strange advertisements sometimes about privacy.
What happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone.
Yeah, it's like, okay, yeah, that's great. But apparently that does not apply to the Mac.
No. And potentially, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, potentially not iOS. Now, there is no standard on that. But basically, there is a DLL file. It's sort of a file that lets your apps run on your computer, every application. Actually, not just App Store applications, but applications in general that run on your computer. They get like this little specialized ID. Basically, I think it's like certificated from Apple, correct me if I'm wrong there, that basically tells Apple exactly what app is running. And not only that, it also tells them where you're running it from, what time you run it at.
And what device even, you ran it from.
What device you ran it from. And all of this is sent to Apple unencrypted, because let's just add a cherry on top of how... Let's call it butchered, this is. I'm going to safely say it probably was not Apple's intention, but let's call it butchered because it's a serious blow for a company whose whole thing is privacy. And we're going to be getting into M1 chips later because that's going to be a fun topic. But this for now, so this is interesting. And I'm curious, I'm going to throw maybe a thought process I've had about Apple in the past, Louis. And I'm curious to hear what you think about it. I don't think inherently Apple doesn't collect data, because I actually think out of every company, they have the potential to collect the most data about you from your devices. But they choose not to because it's better for their current reputation if they don't. But should they need to, they could always flip that switch and follow a similar route to, say, Google or even Microsoft for the matter at this point.
Well, it's also a liability to have someone's data, right? Because you have to protect it. You have to make sure it's not getting stolen by anyone in between. Right. So it's like, yeah, maybe they don't want it to keep their reputation, but maybe they don't want it because they just don't want to deal with it, having to save it and all that stuff. Right. Like we're already like the issues with iCloud Drive not being encrypted and all this FBI stuff. Right. That's already like the most scrutinized thing that Apple has like does right now. Right. It's just the privacy around iCloud Drive and backups. So I can see why they don't want more data. Because they're just going to get more of this, basically.
I was going to say, so, but why have something like this, though? Something that is a checker for these, like, so when we were talking about this, they have the ability to kill switch any app on iOS at the moment, iPadOS included in that, tvOS, anything that isn't basically macOS, they can have a kill switch for, and even macOS, they
probably have at a least not right for. Now.
Yes. So, but my question is, why does this, I understand, this little uniform number, they use it to disable apps maybe that they don't like or viruses or whatever. Why is it has to collect all this other information though? If the argument is for security, well then why does the user not have a choice to opt out of that? Because that seems like a lot of information to give, like a switch, like in the settings tab of your iOS app. Like why is this, and why is it unencrypted? That's actually a big one that I don't understand at all. But
well, maybe the reason for the certificates makes sense. You want to make sure that the program you're running, you know, isn't malware and all that stuff. And then Apple can know that, okay, yeah, this program is good, so you're good to use it, right? The other data, though, they really don't need. And I'm not sure why they collected it in the first place, aside from maybe it was, maybe when they had it originally, it just ended up, they forgot about it. Maybe this implemented so long ago that it was before Apple took such a strong stance on privacy and they just forgot to update this, right? Like, I don't see that happening, but maybe it did. The fact that it's set unencrypted is probably the most scary thing there is about this, because from that data, people, if there's a middleman or it gets sent to someone else, you don't know that. People can find out where you live. They can find out your routine, right? If you go home to work to, like, say, a coffee shop, you do that pretty often. They'll always know they'll always know what you're doing and where you are. So it's very, I don't know, it's really scary to think that someone could just grab that data and just follow you, essentially, and maybe show up at your house one day.
It's crazy. And if it is an oversight, like you're saying, it's a massive oversight for a company whose entire reputation at the moment, anyways, is kind of based around privacy. That seems like a massive oversight. It could be maybe something that was implemented in the code a while ago, as you were saying. Maybe it was something they didn't think about, because that was just the way that apps... There was a time, actually, iOS apps, for the most part, weren't using, like, HTTPS. That was not a normal thing for a while. Maybe it's something left over from that. But I will bring up... This does bring up something that's a little scary, though, is the idea that Apple is able to, if they decide they don't want an app to work on a device, because let's say they're feuding with the company, Epic Games, if you've never heard of them, It could show the potential that Apple could and would kill an app because it doesn't want to deal with it right now.
You know, and it doesn't even need to be on the App Store. Because this is all certificate-based, it could just revoke every certificate for that app because they have the identifier for the application. So they know what it is, right? So if they ever had an issue, they could just flip a switch and then, you know, let's say Clean My Mac is like an app, right? Let's say it's deleting, you know, like, I don't know, maybe they're just feuding with it or whatever. They're just like, okay, a flip of a switch and Clean Mac will no longer work on any Mac. That's, you know, past, present, and future because of the certificates, right? That's crazy because it's not even an app that they controlled in the first place in the App Store. Any program that's on your Mac, they can see and can revoke access to it any time if they have the need.
And the only way I could think about maybe going past is if you just outright disable if you disable the security features of the Mac.
Exactly.
Which ain't great either.
The other, I don't know if we brought this up yet, but basically the whole reason that this has come up is because a couple weeks ago, Apple's certificate server called TrustD went down, so no one could open any application on their Mac because it was connected to the internet, but it couldn't connect to the server. So because of that, it couldn't connect and log the data, basically. So then the workaround was to install a program called Little Snitch, which lets you disable certain basically internet services trying to exit your computer. It lets them block it, so then it'll act like it's offline, essentially, to that service.
Or I was going to say, if you turned off your internet access, that would also work.
Exactly.
Because then if you could communicate.
Exactly. I'm not sure how it works, but I assume it would log the data onto a text file onto your computer and then upload it later, potentially, right? So they're definitely trying to get your data. And this is, you know, the fact that we can turn it off now is great. But what's going to happen with the new M1 chips? We haven't gotten them yet. We don't know if we can turn it off yet, because if it's going to be like, you know, iPhones and iPads where we can't turn anything off, essentially, about what our computer is able to send, you know, aside from like the privacy settings and all that. If we can't do that in Mac, then what's to stop them from just collecting even more data that we have no idea they're collecting?
I mean, I was going to say, even on iOS, before we go on to the M1 chips, there is a feature on iOS, if you dig through your location settings, called Significant Locations. Louis, I'm sure you've seen it a few times here and there.
Yeah.
That's literally a setting, that is a location setting on your phone that allows your phone to know locations that are, quote unquote, significant to you, that you spend a significant amount of time at, such as your home, maybe your school, you know, your workplace, and your phone will actually keep those around. And to be very clear, you can turn the setting off. I'm gonna make a safe assumption most people don't even know it exists, though. But it's a setting on your phone that tracks your location, and probably better than even something like an Android phone could do, because unless you're using a Pixel, which is a Google phone, let's say you're using a Samsung actually kind of manages those stuff on their own. So they can kind of manage, oh, do we want there to be location settings? In fact, I believe on Samsung, they have their own significant location thing, as opposed to Pixels, which also have their own Google version of it. So it is kind of interesting to see Apple sort of stepping into that realm where they actually have a, and they control everything on the phone. There's not a single thing they don't control. So there's the amount of data they could potentially collect is insane, and not being able to turn it off is a possibility because there's nobody else in the phone. It's only Apple.
It's definitely very interesting. You know, the whole idea with significant locations, I'm assuming that it's just stored on device and not uploaded anywhere.
But I believe so.
Do we really know that?
That's true.
We have Unless you have a network monitor and you have cellular off and you just have it on Wi-Fi and you're checking, right? Like, yeah, they say one thing, but you don't really know until you test it yourself, right?
I was going to say, even if you were to do that, though, if you're watching packets fly by, for example, using something like Wireshark, I mean, if they're encrypted packets, mm-hmm. there's not much you can even dig through from there, which I'm going to make a safe assumption.
That's true. But at least they're encrypted. Yeah. I mean, at least it's encrypted. This coming out of the Mac is not encrypted whatsoever. It's basically just a text file being sent across the internet that anyone can grab at any point with crucial location data of where you are at different points of the day and what program you're using at that moment. It's a huge violation of privacy. And if they don't fix this, then my goodness, there's going to be a bit of a backlash from the tech community. Maybe not so much the consumer markets, but at least the tech community will definitely be outraged by this.
Yeah. I mean, so okay, but let's go ahead and let's move on. Let's move on to M1 because these two issues kind of tie together, and we're going to go deeper into maybe some of the issues that could potentially come up with Apple moving to their own silicon. But I kind of want to start with this question. Louis, without even talking about M1 yet, how are you feeling about M1 with the information you have? I'm curious.
Okay, so the information I have, which I...
Any discussion yet.
Right,
so far.
Right. Yeah. I am actually very confident in it. Because... No, that's it. I'm confident it will go over well. You know, I think from what I've seen, as you know, I have some information. From what I've seen, it is buttery smooth. You know, things will, of course, get better once they're written natively. But for the moment, everything runs the same, essentially, as they do now on an Intel-based Mac. And, I'm very confident that's going to do well. You know, I'm excited to see how these new chips will perform in comparison to not only Intel, but compared to other, as in the iPad chips as well. And I'm pretty confident that, you know, things are going to go well regardless, I think. But this first generation, I think, will be the toughest for Apple and consumers, at least for consumers to get on board with, because they don't know if their programs will run essentially yet and if they will run correctly yet. So, Photoshop isn't coming until January. So people are speculating, okay, well, if Photoshop isn't ready, what about the rest of the Adobe suite, right? What about other programs that, you know, aren't as big in the creative space, right? Like, it's definitely going to be some experimenting the consumer base to see what's going on, and maybe the best option would be to go in person to an Apple store and see it. Obviously, we're in a pandemic right now, so don't do this in mass, right? Make an appointment. So it's just you. But I definitely think people need to do their research before they get into it to make sure that everything that they currently do will continue to work still. That is, I think, going to be the biggest thing for consumers.
So, I definitely feel, I'll throw this out there first. The event was obviously very exciting. Apple does a great job with their events.
Yes, it was interesting.
Yeah, we haven't really, in fact, we actually haven't really talked about any of the events, how the experience of the events on this podcast. I will say for the most part, I do say Apple probably does the best with their events in this new online presentation style thing. But anyways, moving on from that, the event to me, there was a lot of things they said. So for example, they're like, oh, we got 2x better performance, so a third better, I think, GPU performance and all at lower power. They basically said, we got more performance, lower power than all our competitors. Didn't actually say who their competitors were in the slides, which I found to be a big issue. But the numbers that we've seen so far from some other reviewers out there have said that Apple's devices are at least meeting some of their claims, which is quite interesting. Now, obviously neither we are have a Mac, one of the new MacBooks or anything like that.
Right, yeah, they're still on pre-order, I believe. They're not available until the next couple days.
Basically, unless you're someone that Apple's sending the computer to early,
you don't have it yet.
So I'm going to say I'm far more skeptical of the M1 chip. At least first gen. And to be very clear, I think future, they're going to do really well with it. I don't foresee Apple failing at this at the moment if everything they say is true for this generation. However, I think I 100% agree with you. Compatibility is going to be the biggest downfall of this Gen 1 M1 chip.
Definitely. Just because it takes developers time, because they basically have to rewrite their entire program from the ground up to work with this new architecture, right? Some stuff you might be able to keep, but basically you're going to have to retune it. Rewrite parts of it and stuff like that. One other thing that I think is going to be a big downside of the M1 chip is just some weird constraints that it has. Like, Thunderbolt, you can only have 2 ports of Thunderbolt at the same time, right? Why is that? The Mac community doesn't have 10 gig internet. Why is that?
Yeah.
Right?
So I have a bit, so I was kind of reading into some documentation and a few other, I guess I would call them tech heads in the community that have been kind of digging into it. So it seems to be at the moment, the M1 chip, the current one, to be clear, there does seem to be something else in the works for the bigger Pro, which by the way, we're going to come back around to the fact that the Air and the Pro and the Mini now all have the same chip, which could be problematic depending on how you look at that, or great. But either way, so the interesting part about it seems the M1 chip doesn't have as much bandwidth as something like an Intel, AMD, or even, I don't know about a Qualcomm. I actually am not aware of how many the Snapdragon has in comparison. As far as I know, I can't think of a Windows always on that's had Thunderbolt, but moving from that. So the Apple Silicon chip is only capable of handling one Thunderbolt controller chip, which is just hence why they can only have 2 Thunderbolt ports. And that also seems to be the reason that they can't have 10 gig, because they had to choose between Thunderbolt and 10 gig, and they opted for 10 gig instead. That's an interesting limitation, though, because that's showing that there is some level of limitation to this new Apple Silicon stuff. It doesn't seem like it has as much bandwidth, and it also seems that it's an SoC. And if you don't own an SoC, that's a system on a chip. Everything is in one chip rather than spread across a motherboard that you may be more used to. That also means it can't have as much RAM. It's got unified RAM. It can only go up to 16 gigabytes so far, which that's going to be interesting if, you know, on the Pro models, I imagine they're going to have more, but it's a possibility they might not be able to get more than 16 gigs per SoC.
Right. Which will be,
I don't know.
I don't even know how to feel about it, because it's like, okay, it's 16 gigs. That's not great. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but the iPad Pro only has like 6 gigs of RAM, and it can export 4K video, like in a snap, right?
But that's
a different encoding entirely.
Not even just that. I was gonna say I love the iPad Pro. As many of you know from this podcast that I've spoken about before, I attempt to daily drive it occasionally because I love it so much. I also acknowledge it is terrible at multitasking, though, and I think it has to do partially with that 6 gigs of RAM. Just be straight up. I think that's probably the biggest issue with this iPad, is that 6 gigs is a limitation. And on a Mac, especially since they're... By the way, also I'm annoyed because you can't move Windows on iPad OS, but Mac OS with the same chip can move Windows, you know, across the desktop without issue now.
Oh, you mean like in Parallels?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, only 16 gigs of RAM, which I am expecting on a Mac might be an issue if you are doing video editing and you have a browser open and you've got something else open, because on a Mac you can move all that stuff, whereas an iPad you only have 6 gigs, yes, but you can only have 3 apps on the screen at once, and like one of them is like half of the actual app rather than the full app. So I don't know, that's gonna be interesting to see maybe the restrictions or limitations that might be on that because mm-hmm. of that limitation.
I can definitely see video editing taking a hit from the lack of RAM, especially development as well. Like for developers, when they run these giant programs, you know, it's going to be the possibility that these new Macs won't be able to be upgraded to the minimum requirements of these new, of these rewritten programs, essentially, right? Like, if you have 16 gigabytes of RAM, if your program needs 17, well, you're out of luck. You can't even run it on your own new shiny computer because you just don't have enough RAM.
I mean, if you're, and to be very clear, if your program can even run on those computers in the first place because of the ARM architecture. Like, so let's, we're kind of ragging on M1 a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the actual specs of it so we can kind of, you can kind of get the context of what we're talking about. So in terms of performance, now, again, there haven't been a huge amount of numbers out there. I think there's only one or two independent sets of numbers out there that aren't from Apple. It seems to imply that at least CPU-wise, they're going to be faster than even the 16-inch MacBook Pro in terms of their actual clock speeds and scores that they get in Geekbench and all that. That's fairly interesting. I'll be straight. That is a really interesting score, especially if that's coming from a MacBook Air, as they seem to be imply. Because that would mean that at least on a just performance, on paper spec, they have some of the fastest CPUs you can get in a computer, period. And that's awesome. That's great to see. And thermally...
And that's without cooling, because it's the MacBook Air.
True. Exactly. So if that's the case, and to be clear, and maybe that was one run. That was only one. They didn't do multiple runs, because I feel like multiple runs, you might run into some throttling here and there, because no fan, obviously. That's where I think that, and that's interesting. And now I'm going to bring up the topic. We got the Air, the Pro, and the Mini. Now, the Mini and the Air, I actually find far less offensive to have the same chip. The 13-inch Pro is a weird one for me, though. I actually am kind of, I don't know. I'm weirded out by the fact that it has the same chip as the Air. Like, and I'm not saying there's really, as far as specs-wise goes, they have the exact same chip and even the same layout. The only difference seems to be the chassis and the fact that the Pro has a fan and touch bar, which, love that. It's an extra $200 for that, basically. Now, Louie and I kind of talked about it on launch day, maybe what some of the differences are. We were thinking maybe the TDP is a little different between devices because Apple didn't seem to mention that, like, they honestly didn't seem to know the difference themselves.
No, they didn't mention clock speeds, they didn't mention thermals, they didn't mention TDP, they didn't mention anything aside from M1 better, Intel bad.
Basically.
Yep.
So, I don't, between the two, before, it's funny, if you looked at the 13-inch MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air, like, I already didn't like the fact that they were so similar. Like, unless you start, and here's the thing, here's the weird part. If you step up to $1,800 for the 13-inch MacBook Pro, that's actually an Intel MacBook. So, what that tells me is Apple either knows or is not confident in their M1 chip to perform at that $1,800 level that the Intel one currently performs at. And also, you get 4 ports with the Intel one, which, and they're all Thunderbolt.
Right, right. My take is just that because they know it's a first generation, they know it's not going to be their best yet, right? Like maybe by the end of the 2 years they refresh the Mac Mini, the MacBook Pro 13, and the Air again, and then they'll have the complete. I think that's what they're riding on, is the idea that by the end of the 2 years, they will have basically matched the gigabit stuff. They've matched the Thunderbolt stuff. Any other limitations they've overcame by then. So I can definitely see that these Gen 1 devices essentially getting support dropped within 3-4 years because they're so like an oddity in the lineup. Much like the first Apple Watch, right? like they changed the name to Series Zero, and then it was dropped within 2 years, right?
So, it was basically a flop device.
Exactly. Yeah, it's first gen. Because it's a first-gen device. The iPad, the first iPad that came out, only got 3 years of updates and then was dropped. Right? So it's a trend. And this was mentioned in Linus Tech Tips video. It's a trend that Apple does where, you know, the first generation, they know is not going to be their best performing because it's a first-generation device. I mean, any first-generation device, any company, is most like I can think of, you know, the Oculus first generation was expensive and not super great for the price, you know, and now we're on the third gen and it's like the most popular VR consumer headset out there. Where I can think of the Galaxy Fold, right? The first one, you know, had all these issues, and then now the second one seems to resolve pretty much most of them, right? So it's just the nature that comes with having a first generation device. That's
it is. So, but it's weird to me. In particular, so this is a weird one for me, though. Because if this was a first-gen device, though, like, with all the devices you mentioned, there was Series Zero, the iPad, those were sort of one-off devices, though. There was the iPad, and there was the Series Zero watch. There was not a Series Zero, watch, and then the Series Zero Pro, and that, or the, you know, iPad and iPad Pro when it first came out. They started out as one device. What makes me feel that Apple is at least confident enough that this is ready to go is now three devices in their lineup all have the M1 chip. And not only is it just three devices, it's also their most popular laptop, the MacBook Air, and I'm going to safely say probably their most popular desktop, the Mac Mini. And at least on the developer side, the Mac Mini is definitely the most popular side, which they're definitely targeting for that audience in particular. But the MacBook Air is the consumer laptop from Apple. It is the laptop that most people, when they go into an Apple store, they're buying that laptop probably if they're just looking to use a laptop, I guess is what I'm going for there. So it tells me that I feel Apple is confident enough to jump straight in and say, well, our consumers are going to love the M1. That it's ready to go and it's good enough that you can get away with. And to be entirely clear, you probably can. If you're just typing up documents, you're probably totally fine.
Yeah, most definitely. The productivity apps are going to easily function fine. I mean, they showed back at WWDC that Word didn't break your entire document on M1. So there you go, folks. Go buy an M1 Mac because Word no longer breaks the whole document by moving an image.
To be very clear, I'm not trying to wreck the M1 chip, as it were. But Apple's not being very clear about this. And as you said, while I think there's definitely going to be a Gen 2, look at the iPad and iPhone, and you'll actually notice there's a trend of when they update it. The phone, as you know, is an every year thing. Once a year they update it. But the iPads, depending on which iPad it is, has a different set of updates.
Yeah, it's like 18 months for the pros, I believe.
Yeah, it's like 1.5 years for the pro. It's like 2 years for the normal iPad, like the standard budget iPad. The Macs are all on different update cycles. Like the 15 to 16 inch was a weird one from the Air, and the 13 inch, they're all different.
I wonder if this means that, you know, are we going to get new silicon for Macs every year?
That's what I don't know.
Because Intel and AMD, every year we have something new.
Right.
So is Apple going to be on par with that? Because they're going to have to stay competitive with these chips now, right? Because now it's no longer an issue of Mac versus Windows. It's an issue of you know, Mac versus Windows. But also, is this CPU good enough for what I need to do now, right? They've essentially dug their hole even deeper that they're already in, right, by not having a bigger market share. Now they're having a new architecture that no one else uses.
We'll touch on that. I want to touch on that because Windows does have Windows ARM, which is very alive and well as far as like the Surface Pro X. I think they're on V2 now, which Microsoft has done a very good job in supporting. But what's weird to me, so I take the iPad Pro as an example. I'm actually more curious, are they going to be able to keep up with that update cycle? Because the iPad Pro is supposed to be Apple's best and greatest iPad, their fastest, their most powerful iPad. And yet, from Gen 1 iPad Pro, I say Gen 1, I guess it was Gen 2, depending on if you're going big or small, but from Gen 1 iPad Pro, which started with an A12X, you went to iPad Pro Gen 2, which has an A12Z, which is basically the same processor with one more graphics core unlocked. So I guess the question is that all Apple's going to do per year is unlock something that they already had, or are they actually going to every year have a brand new chip that can deliver what Intel and AMD are delivering at the same level of incremental performance?
Like, to be clear, we're not talking about major jumps in performance. Like, Intel and AMD don't do that either. What we want is essentially just incremental upgrades, but every single year across the entire lineup, right?
Not because, what they do with the iPad Pro Gen 2, basically.
No, right. For the iPads, I think it makes a little more sense because it's a different market, right? It's still a different device. Like, people who use a Mac often don't use an iPad. People who use an iPad often don't use a Mac, right? It's usually one or the other. So it's still different markets in the consumer's head, and then in Apple's their plan as well. But the Mac, however, is still in the laptop market. Sure, they put the iPad as a laptop. Sure, they say this and that. They don't treat it like that, though, with update cycles. The Mac also, I feel, isn't updated as often as it should be. It's very lackluster, the updates that they have. Like, it's pretty much just, you know, every year, maybe every other year, it's like, oh, hey, new gen Intel. Cool. Nothing changed. And then maybe every 4 or 5 years, oh, look, a new chassis. Wow. Right? That's pretty much how it goes, just so they can keep things fresh. So are they going to keep doing that? Is there going to be, you know, the four-year chassis design? Is it going to be the every other year chip incremental update, the every year chip incremental update, right? Like, it makes buying laptops from Apple hard because you have to look at the cycle of when they release these things. If it was just yearly and you knew what month it was going to be like in the iPhone, you could just know, oh, I'll just wait one more month and I'll buy a new Mac or whatever, right? It's more predictable for consumers to buy new iPhones because they'll know the cycle. With Macs, it's kind of like you have to do your research, because if you buy this Mac and then, you know, 2 months later, 6 months later, there's a new Mac, you're going to feel terrible, right? Because you suddenly spent all this money and you technically are now outdated.
I mean, and not only just looking at that, like, it, new features that are introduced, like, Macs are weird because 5 years, Apple will keep the exact same design. I mean, for years now, here's a weird thought process for you. Windows, like, every 6 months goes through like a major redesign, and that's either better or worse depending on who you are, but Microsoft just shoots them out like nothing. And it's funny to me because I look at something like iPadOS takes forever to get any new features. Like, even widgets, I'm just gonna say it, were just
a disappointment. Half-assed. They were a disappointment, yeah, on the iPad.
They were half-assed on the iPad. The phone, they were great. I love widgets. Widgets on the phone are wonderful. And you're like, wow, why didn't we have this in our life before? Then you'll get the iPad and you're like, what have you done? It's based on the same OS, so you're even more confused. But beyond the point, at the same time, I look at the Mac and I'm like, okay, so they didn't even redesign the chassis for this M1 launch, though. I don't know if you noticed that, but the chassis are exactly the same down to the millimeter measurements. They're exactly the same, which then leads me to believe, so every 5 years, roughly, it seems like Apple does a redesign of the chassis of the Mac. So it would be either this year or next year, they're going to go through that major redesign. But then I'm like, okay, so why put the M1 in an old chassis, though? Is it because you want it to be familiar to consumers? They're comfortable with it already and they just pick it up and it just works? Is that why? But this is a big event.
I just had an epiphany, possibly. Maybe the reason that these are still in the old chassis is because they know Gen 1 is going to get popped off in 2-3 years. And they want the new perfect M2, M3 chips, whatever they put in it, to be in the slim new designs that they have for the chassis, so that it's really a new Mac, a new era of the Mac, if you can see where I'm getting at. Essentially, like, right now, this is just, for them, a stepping stone. And then when the M2 is fully ready with every single feature that they currently have on Intel Macs, then they get the new design. then you get the 1080p webcam.
Yeah.
Right.
And 1080p and potentially touchscreen, which, by the way, I guess when the Macs add get touchscreen, I guess that's the death of the iPad. That's a rough thought.
No, I know, because it's not of note-taking.
Yeah.
That's honestly the only way that the iPad would still survive is going to be note-taking.
Which is unfortunate, because, as I've said before, I see the iPad as Apple's actual, what they want the consumer PC to be. I think that was their intention, and I think they just didn't put nearly enough time nor effort into it, and that's just left the iPad in a weird place now.
Here's another part of that puzzle, is I think that by moving this architecture to M1 and to, you know, consecutive Apple Silicon iterations, essentially you could now, in theory, wow, I'm using a lot of big words here, you could move over the Pro apps to the iPad almost seamlessly, because it is the same or at least similar architecture.
I agree with you. I wonder if there's going to be issues, though, with things like RAM, though. There's only 6 gigs on the iPad.
Right. They would have to increase the number, the RAM in the iPad, for sure. Or they would have to optimize overhaul the entire program for iPad. And, you know, maybe it's a mini version of Logic. It's not GarageBand, but it's like mini Logic. You can record, you can make basic edits in it. Maybe you're limited to, I don't know, 30 tracks or so, right? However many they think is appropriate for the RAM that's in there.
I was going to say, the day the iPad can record multiple audio streams and output audio to other apps is the day that the iPad will be a laptop replacement.
I agree. I want that so badly. I want to be able to output to more than one, or change which one based in just software rather than having to plug something in. Right? Like, I'm waiting for that day, and when that day comes and when I am able to essentially become a developer solely on iPad through that, that's one other thing that I wish would happen, but I don't think will. But could, right? Because you need, you know, these different compilers within macOS. You download Xcode Select. Basically, you have to download like a special package to get these, to download them. Will we have that option for the iPad? Will we be able to do that? I don't know. We won't know until either it happens or it doesn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it's going to be interesting. And to be very clear, we were ranting a lot on the issues that we think. We didn't even touch on, it's now M1. That there's a possibility you won't be able to change anything on it anymore. You won't be able to install Windows on this, to be very clear.
Oh, yeah, no, you can't. You can't. Boot camp is gone.
Or
it's
Linux.
Dead.
Yeah.
Well, Linux has been dead in boot camp since the T2 chip came out.
T2.
Yeah.
But it's going to be interesting. And regardless, in summary, this does have the potential, whether Apple fails or not with this, it does have the potential to change the entire industry. And I think it's already going to. I think we're going to see a lot more ARM laptops out there. And I think it's going to be game-changing, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, it's going to force... Unfortunately, it's going to very much fragment the entire market of laptops and PCs. Because now developers, you know, just to support Windows, you're going to have to write two different versions of your software, right? Because there's going to be the Windows desktop by the consumer market, which, you know, the build-your-own PC market. And then you're going to have the laptop Windows market, that's ARM. You have to have two different versions, you know, and I can really see a lot of programs that are currently on Mac, just because it's Intel, right, not coming back because of the greater industry move to ARM, right? Because developers, if you currently support Windows and Mac, right, you're writing two different source code files, right? And even with this transition to architecture transition, you still have to write just two versions of your code, though, which is, or no, three, in fact, if you continue to support old Mac Intel Macintosh, right? So technically you're supporting three now if you continue to support Mac OS. Now with the move of Windows to ARM, you're going to be writing four different versions of your program. It just doesn't make any sense, and you're going to drop off whichever one or whichever two have the least amount of user activity.
So what we're saying basically is, don't buy a Mac right now. Wait until at least next year, whenever they release the M2 or whatever. Or if you can even wait longer than that, wait 2 years. Because then Apple's whole lineup will be done. Developers will have had a little bit more time to do the transition. And by then also, I assume a lot of Microsoft's Windows partners will also have begun that transition if it's successful. So you might actually have some other options to look into. But with that, we're going to go ahead and go on a break, and we'll be right back. Okay, and we are back. So let's talk about everyone's favorite consoles. Actually, I think Nintendo makes everyone's favorite consoles, but beyond the point, PS5 and Xbox are here now.
Just to touch on that Nintendo, just one little tidbit. They sold more consoles in all of October than any console ever, aside from the Wii. In that 2008 Wii. So people really like Nintendo. Okay, but the topic.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, when I started talking, I was gonna say everyone's favorite consoles. Then I realized Nintendo makes everyone's favorite console in reality. Yeah. So either way though, you know, PS5 and Xbox, those are the ones that people defend the most vigorously. Like, it's weird. Nobody says Nintendo makes bad consoles. Like, you never hear about the Nintendo console wars. You only hear Xbox v PS5.
What? It's probably just because Nintendo doesn't make typical consoles. They make, they are like probably the most creative console makers, because it's not just like a box that sits under your TV, right? Like there's the motion controls, and that's how you play every game, and the Switch is portable but also dockable, right? So like, Nintendo is just built different. That's why. That's probably why.
Yeah. Either way, this topic line has nothing to do with Nintendo, and that's just sort of prod from passing, but there you go. Now we've just established it. Nintendo is the best console. Either way. So, within, I don't know, how long was it? 5 seconds? All of the PS5s and Xbox were sold out everywhere. So, and to be clear, not just the most expensive or the cheapest ones, all of them, all four consoles were gone. I think... So in our podcast, we generally don't touch on that much console stuff, because consoles kind of sit around for, what is it, 6 or 7 years? Like, how long, when did the last, 2013 was the last set of consoles, I think, 2014?
Gosh, yeah, that sounds about right around then, yeah.
So that's when the last consoles were released. So we don't really tend to talk about them unless something significant comes out, because it really... they kind of don't change that much from year to year. I mean, there are the occasional Pro refreshes.
Or like the S refresh. Slims.
You get some of those, but you really don't see much. It is interesting. I think this is actually the first year. Because, and be very clear, when I game, I generally game on PC.
As do I.
And yeah, so does Louis. So I don't really tend to pay that much attention to consoles. I will say this might be the first year that I'm looking at consoles and be like, you know what? You kind of got my attention a little bit. I'm minded a little bit. I may not buy one, but I'm like, you know what? But you got my attention now.
Yeah, they did a big enough change to, maybe they didn't capture everyone, but they at least turned more heads than they have in the past. And that is key in selling more consoles and getting more sales, essentially.
Can I also say, and I know people hate it when you say it like this, the consoles are officially computers, and people need to just accept that. Like, they have AMD graphics cards and CPUs. They are computers.
Yeah, I believe either the Xbox or the PS5, or at least the previous generation, had keyboard and mouse support.
Yes, so, yeah, Xbox.
Right,
yeah.
So you basically just bought a PC then at that point that can only run games.
Yeah. So, and to be clear, I'm not knocking it. Because, in truth be told, for what you're getting in those form factors...
and for the price, you are getting some amazing hardware, right?
Like, and even some better features. Like, can we just, for a second, when you have a gaming PC, one of the most antagonizing things about it is closing a game and reopening it. And Xbox, at least, the quick resume thing, that's awesome. Like... I don't know if there's a single... unless you're loading things into your RAM on your computer, which, by the way, is horrible to do. You're not getting that same snappy just reload. So,
I suppose the argument for that is just use, you know, the fastest 1 terabyte SSD that is ever made. Like, I think Intel makes, like, whatever it's called. Intel.
Oh, Optane.
Yeah, Optane. That's, like, the fastest SSD. But what these consoles have done is essentially, you know, they claim to be generations ahead of PC, and they're not in terms of what they have to offer, but they are for what they have to offer at that price. Because the Intel SSD by itself is like $700 probably, right? It's expensive. So the fact that these consoles are able to do it at about half the price of a comparable gaming PC, if we're being honest here, is very impressive.
Can we also talk about, I was going to say, in particular with the PS5, I don't believe the Xbox offers the same modularity where you can replace the storage and all that. But in the PS5, you can actually replace certain components like the SSD, and potentially, because right now the SSD in the PS5 is, I believe it's NVMe based, which means it's super fast, and Optane doesn't quite reach those speeds right now. But there is a chance later down the line, let's say 2 or 3 years down the line, when Intel, you know, makes Optane even faster, you could actually change out that old SSD in your PS5, put that new Optane one, all of a sudden you're getting the reduced latency, plus the same speed you were seeing before, or more. Like, the potential for that is insane. And it seems like they're kind of both just neat. I mean, like, the game streaming from Microsoft is really cool. PlayStation's
If I'm not mistaken, I think the Xbox also has the same SSD upgrade, but it's proprietary. So that's why it hasn't. I'm almost positive I read this, that it was proprietary. So everyone was like, so you can buy the cheap end Xbox, but then pay later an arm and a leg to upgrade the SSD, right? So it's, you know, like, great, you can upgrade it, but just kidding, because you have to use a proprietary one. Where PS5, you can basically use any NVMe SSD and just pop it in there, and there you go.
They both did, I'm gonna be honest, they both also kind of did weird stuff this year. So, like, Microsoft with the very proprietary internal stuff, like, they don't really want you to touch anything, but they'll let you buy more storage that you plug in, but only that storage will work. Granted, you can also put any game you want on any storage on the Xbox, whereas PlayStation only lets you put the new games on the new storage, and old games have to go on a different storage, which is weird. And only PS4 games. There's no background. The PS5 does not allow you to go back through the generations. The Xbox does.
Yeah, Xbox. Another weird thing. You can use up to, like,
the original.
The original Xbox, right?
The original
that
Xbox.
Is
There's a few
crazy
games.
Crazy cool.
It's weird. And even, okay, but even the PlayStation controller. So Xbox said, Microsoft said, hey, bring your old controllers. They'll work perfectly fine with our new console. Sony was like, no, you gotta buy only the new controllers. You can use the old ones, but they'll only work with the old games. It's like, what? It's weird. And to be very clear, the controllers for the new DualSense controllers are kind of neat. They have new haptic bumpers, and they have a bunch of other features that make them really cool. I don't know if you would need them to experience, you know, newer games. So, like, they add to the experience, obviously, but I don't think they're essential, if that makes sense.
Right. It's, I think it's kind of unfortunate on Sony's side to do that, right? Because here you have Xbox basically having full backwards compatibility with every single generation of Xbox since they've been coming out. Like, even before Xbox was owned by Microsoft, right? Like, those games still work because it's the original Xbox. It makes you wonder, you know, what was... You know, this reminds me as well as way back when Xbox pricing got announced or leaked. Sony ended up down pricing the PS5 because apparently they were going to price it much higher than what they have it for now to be competitive with the Xbox. But I just think it's interesting that, you know, they're kind of competing in almost two different, you know, ecosystems at this point, because, you know, Xbox, you have the Game Cloud Pass, you can have full backwards compatibility. You know, it reassures you that you don't need to buy the current console, the new console right now, You can stick to your current console and upgrade when you feel like it, because guess what? Your current games will still run on it, right? You're not going to have to replace every single game that you have.
I mean, and on that, and I was going to say, on that topic as well, both of these console creators also have a version of their console that doesn't have a disc drive anymore. They said, download all the games. You don't need physical media like you used to need anymore. And that was it. It's weird. It's really weird. And at the same time, for some reason, even though I think they both have they both have really compelling consoles this year, they're also having a lot of issues that are causing, like, so Sony, when, all right, let's put some context. Sony, when they came out on stage, when they announced PS5, they're like, the PS5 has this awesome new storage that lets us do revolutionary things with games. It also bricks consoles occasionally.
Yeah. It's essentially the SSD is accidentally corrupting game files. So then, game files. So then the game, when you reboot it, might not load. It'll just stay on the loading screen the whole time. Or it could have the worse effect, which is bricking the entire console and you have to send it back for a new one. This is entirely software, I hope. Unless they're shipping with SSDs that are just have some hardware flaw in them, that would be very sad considering they've sold every single PS5 they had already, and they're going to have to recall essentially all of them if this is a hardware issue, or send new SSDs to every single user for free because it's not their fault. Right. Either way, it's going to be a massive cost for Sony if it's hardware. If it's software, then it's not so bad. You just tell the people who just bought a $600 console, don't use it yet until we get a software update to fix it. That's not going to go over well. So essentially, Sony is not in a good position right now.
No. And so that's where Sony's at. Microsoft's on the other hand. Now, Microsoft seems to be far more benign, just more annoying, seems to be the issue, where it makes like a clicky noise, although people aren't quite sure what it is, and Microsoft themselves doesn't actually seem to know what it is either. But the guess is right now that it's either fan or disk drive related. So that's another issue. I mean, I guess it's not as bad as Sony's, but also for your brand new console that came out. And the Xbox does not have a good reputation. The last Xbox was sort of a dumpster fire. I say sort of. The last Xbox was a dumpster fire where people were throwing their Xboxes in the dumpster to set on fire. It was not great. So, you know, this year it seems like launches in general have been pretty botched across the board.
If you look at, you know, consoles, these launches have not been great. And then you look at the other side of things, PC hardware, you know, the greatest graphics cards that are coming out, they sell out within essentially the same amount of time, within seconds. And then it turns out later that these third-party graphics cards made by MSI, Asus, etc., have a faulty, small little resistors essentially or capacitors that are a little bit faulty or aren't the same standard. They're not as high quality, and so you're getting these basically graphical issues and crashes in games, and the only way to fix it, because hardware, they have to recall the graphics cards, you know, or somehow undervolt the graphics card to fix it in software. But still, it's like you bought a $500 graphics card, or, you know, in some cases, a $1,600 graphics card, because that's what came out first, and you can't use it because of some third-party decision. So it's just launches this year have just not been, you know, it's been a rough year for launches this year, we'll put it that way.
Yeah. But either way, I mean, I will say, again, out of all the years, though, this is the first year that's actually made me look at consoles and actually be like, okay, I'm paying attention because these consoles look great.
Right.
And, like, they support 4K 120 frames. That's insane. Like, for a PC of similar spec, I don't know, how much would that cost?
For a PC of that price, my gosh, or for a console of that price, I mean, you're probably looking at definitely at least $1,000, right?
I was gonna say around 700, 800, but even close enough to 1,000.
Well, because yeah. I mean, like, you got to factor in the graphics card, right? The 3070 will not be able to handle 4K 120 FPS. You're going to have to buy a 3080, not a 3090, but a 3080. That card, that's the between $700 and $800, right? That's already your entire budget surpasses the console at that point.
And to be very clear, the consoles, while they do support 4K 120, their ray tracing is not technically called ray tracing, but their ray tracing is not the same level as one of those graphic cards, to be very clear. Visually, the graphic cards will still perform better. But at that price of the consoles, that's a hard sell, especially if you're just playing the game and you just want to enjoy the game.
Right. And I honestly, the whole idea around ray tracing and all that, it's like, oh, this is so cool. There's maybe 10 games that I can list that have ray tracing or that at least support it well enough to be used. And it's like, yeah, NVIDIA is like, oh yeah, we got ray tracing now. Look at how good this marble looks, how shiny it is. Wow. Like, okay, great. But you're still charging an arm and a leg for, you know, like, you should not be buying a graphics card because of ray tracing. That's just, like, simple.
No. It's like 5G phones.
Exactly.
Don't buy a new phone because of 5G.
Exactly.
That's the same idea. Don't buy a graphics card because of ray tracing. Buy it because it's actually a better card. Which, to be very clear, the 30 series is better than the 10 series or the 20 series, for the matter. And if you have a 10 series, might want to think about buying one. Yeah.
Obviously, we don't know, you know, we have some idea of how RDNA 2, you know, Big Navi, will turn out, but we really don't know because they're not out yet, as far as I know. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I don't think they're available to consumers yet.
Not till, by the time this podcast comes out, though, it should be out in roughly 2 days.
Okay, so
the 18th.
Yes, so there you go. So we you know, the graphics cards wars will heat up soon.
I'm hoping, from everything AMD said, they should have at least one card that is equivalent to the 3080, which, if true, they made the generational jumps they made to get there are insane.
You know, and I'm confident in this new architecture because of what we're seeing in these consoles now, right? If this console at $500 for the whole system can do 4K 144 FPS, what can a similarly priced graphics card alone do from AMD, right? Like, obviously, it probably won't be the same. It's probably, you know, a stripped-down graphics card, just the bare PCB in there, or however that works, however they build these consoles. But it will be a bit more. But still, it's the fact they're able to do that, you know, for such a low price. Exactly. It's very, very, it inspires confidence in me, at least, for their new generation.
And you know what's funny? I was thinking about this the other day. Like, no matter which way, for the most part, no matter which side of gaming you sort of fall on, if you buy an AMD GPU when that finally comes out, or you buy a console, AMD sort of just wins overall. Like, in a weird, like, there's no NVIDIA console. There's AMD consoles, there's the AMD graphics, AMD CPU, of course, but there really is no, there's no Intel GPU yet. I say, we've been waiting a while. And NVIDIA is really only graphics cards. And granted, NVIDIA's hold on the market is absolute. And unlike Intel, I think they actually understand that. And they have been sort of, I mean, the 3090 is NVIDIA showing their muscles. The last podcast, Patrick and I definitely talked about that out of the lot. NVIDIA is still, as performance-wise, is still king. For now.
Right, performance-wise, but the key to the consumer market is price to performance. And if you can beat NVIDIA at that, then you start to slowly chip away at their user base. It might not be an immediate flip of the switch, oh, we've gained 30% market share. It's going to be, you know, 2-3% probably per quarter or per half year or something like that. I'm not sure entirely because we haven't seen it yet.
Sorry to cut you off. It's gonna be really weird to think about. You can now build a full red system, and it's not crazy.
And it's not it's actually beneficial because of the way that the CPU and the GPU can talk to each other for caching. It is actually beneficial, and the RAM, it's beneficial for you to buy full red, because you know, if you buy Intel, if you do mix and match, you're not gonna get the same benefits with RAM and caching and all that. But if you buy full red, there's a lot of added benefit to just, you know, you don't even have to build a high-end system, but you would still get that benefit, at least somewhat.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, Intel and NVIDIA don't have the advantage. Now, granted, NVIDIA, with their purchase of ARM, might make a difference there.
Yeah.
Now,
do you think we're going to see NVIDIA CPUs?
I don't think an NVIDIA CPU, but even if they made like a logic processor or something else that could act as an intermediary, yeah, between the CPU and GPU, I could see NVIDIA doing that since they already have all that tech in place and they own all that.
Interesting. I could see that as well.
Or actually, I think a cooler one. What if Windows computers have ARM processors, NVIDIA integrated graphics?
Oh my gosh.
It's a weird thought, but I could. That is. I mean, it's NVIDIA.
Really strange to think about.
Also, I would just like to say, you know, I don't want to go back to M1 that much. Apple's GPUs, I think so far, seem like the weakest link of their whole setup. We didn't really talk about their GPUs.
Oh, true.
Yeah, I think being the weakest link, and I don't foresee them. You could maybe throw out your opinion on this. I don't foresee them putting a discrete graphics in any of their
SoCs, at least, and any other SoCs.
Their SoCs, yes.
Right, because for the Mac Pro, they're going to have a separate. They're going to have a CPU separately, because otherwise, there's no way you're going to be able to sell any of those at all anymore if you're selling it with 16 gigabytes of RAM at most.
Actually, even thinking about that, I mean, basically, for all intents and purposes, the PS5 and Xbox are basically SoC consoles. Like, they're just SoC chips. Because they're not the chips are not separated in a console. So I guess that means, like, if you have like a always on PC from Windows or a new Mac from Apple, you just can't have a discrete graphics, and everything's only going to be one company's chip. It's going to be one company's SoC, which is, that's a thought.
That's definitely an interesting idea. I wonder how, would there be any pressure then at that point to, aside from at the high end, would there be any pressure to update your graphics capabilities then? If it's all integrated and you don't, and no one is offering discrete graphics aside from PC builders, essentially, right? Then is there any reason to upgrade your, other than to be, in the Windows market, is different. You have to compete with other Windows laptops. In the Mac market, who do you compete with other than like the greater Windows market, right? And even then, you're not really competing with them aside from, because they don't, I'm gonna be honest, Macs and Windows do not do the same thing. They are, at least in my mind, just entirely different systems. Like, yeah, they can do similar things. They can run some of the same programs, but when it comes down to needing to do hard work, they do not do the same things
so I mean, what we're saying here basically is Apple's going to kill Adobe on the Mac and it'll just be Logic or Final Cut. No, I'm just kidding on that end, but I mean, obviously Apple has that first party advantage.
That's true.
Yeah, they like, for example, them being able to walk out on stage with a new Mac with an M1 chip and say Logic and Final Cut have been working for months now is because Adobe obviously doesn't have a Mac with an M1 chip in the back closet. So I don't know. These consoles are really interesting, and they bring forward a lot more questions, I guess, than I thought they were going to. I mean,
not just like in the console market, but regarding the greater computer market, it's very much a big question mark how the market will move in terms of, you know, I think both companies have said this is their final console, I believe. So, you know, and Microsoft said Windows 10 is their final version of Windows. So what does that mean? Are we done having these generational upgrades? Are we?
I mean, we're definitely moving into like everything's a service now. Everything is a service now. Ugh, there is no more product. I have a
headache
releases.
Just thinking about that. Why? I understand it makes you more money, but please don't do that. I don't know. I hope at least they have an option to just have the single, you know, like everything. You know, I wish most programs would have the, you know, the subscription and then the one-time lifetime purchase. Like, that is what I want. I don't care if it's four times the amount. I don't want to be paying a subscription. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the world we live in now. And that's,
you know,
man, game...
It's the argument, you know, it's only a cup of coffee a day. Okay, but when everything that I use every day is a cost of a cup of coffee a day, I'm buying the whole restaurant every single day, right? It's not going to work.
I don't, it's going to be weird. I mean, Microsoft even seems to be at the point where they really don't even care about the actual Xbox hardware. For example, you can actually get the base level Xbox, the Series, is it X or S that's lower? S. So the Series S, which is the lower version, you can do basically a financial like month payment for that console through GameStream, where you're basically paying what is it, $10 a month, or actually like $5 a month for the console plus GameStream. Like, you're paying like $15 in total for GameStream plus this console for 2 years. And then you just keep paying GameStream after you're done paying for the console, but you basically didn't pay for the console at all. It was basically free with GameStream.
Essentially, it's the idea that you don't own your hardware until we say you do.
It's like a phone carrier plan, actually.
Oh, God. Man, those are the worst.
So everything's a phone carrier plan now. That's what we're saying. Anyways... We're gonna end the podcast here. I will mention, apparently YouTube Rewind is canceled this year, so I don't know if you want, YouTube didn't want to break their dislike record this year. That's sad. Elon Musk may have COVID. Go read up on that yourselves. The tests have been all over the place. It's actually kind of interesting to read, because he's obviously a big, I'm gonna call him a celebrity. He is a celebrity for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, pretty much.
They really went into the COVID testing. I think it's actually fairly interesting to read up on. Careful with those fake news, though, because of course those exist.
Right. Always check your sources.
Always check your sources.
You look at multiple websites, multiple references, look for, you know, credited places to look, find your research, please. Don't go to, you know, WikiLeaks.
I was going to say, Reddit's probably not even a good place to go for that at this point. Stay on your sources. Anyways, with that, also, good job for everyone for voting. Thumbs up for that. We did not mention the last podcast. They got posted too late. We'll get them next year.
Yeah, next year.
Anyways, guys, we will see you guys next week. And yeah, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, YouTube.
Instagram.
I forgot about Instagram. That's actually the biggest platform. Follow us on all of those things. Subscribe on your podcast if you can. Leave 5 stars. Love comments. We will read through them if you leave them. Please do. And with that, we'll go ahead and we'll end it here.
Sounds good.
Yeah. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.